Welcome back to the Lutheran History Podcast, where we cover 500 years, and now over 500 years of Lutheran history. Today's guest is Michael Holman. I'll let him introduce himself and tell us a bit what we're going to talk about today. Michael, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here. My name is Michael Holman, and I am a pastor in the Missouri Synod at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Fairmont. I wasn't always a member of the Missouri Synod. I grew up in the ELS in Albert Lea, Minnesota, and went to Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato. And a couple years after that, I actually started seminary at Bethany Lutheran Theological Seminary in Mankato. At the time, though, the ELS was going through their debate over the office of the ministry, and that was not quite settled, but just before I started at the seminary, they passed a resolution, and I don't think we want to get into all the reasons why I ended up deciding to leave Bethany Lutheran Theological Seminary, but I did leave and go to the seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, graduated in 2010. And then I was a pastor in Northeast Iowa for the last 12 and a half years and just have been in Fairmont, Minnesota for about 6 months. The stuff that Heffling talks about in his book are stuff that I've been thinking about for 20 years.
So for you, there's a personal reason why you would want to study this topic. Of course, it maybe applies to broader reasons. So, there are some contemporary issues perhaps as the cause of it, but this is a historical podcast. So we'll look at the history of this book and its content. But thank you for sharing kind of why you are why you were very attracted to this topic. So the topic is your translation of the book by J.W.F. Heffling. I guess I should have pronounced the first half in German if I was going to do the second half. But anyway, Johann Wilhelm Friedrich Heffling's book, How the Lutheran Church is Constituted. That's your translation of his title. So you translated this book. We've done a couple translation interviews before, so our audience might know what kind of questions we're going to ask. But first of all, let's get into a little biographical information on Heffling. What can you tell us about him? What were you, and maybe your earliest impressions and how that changed?
Yeah, so I always say Heffling, and my German pronunciation is not very good, so I apologize for anybody listening. But Heffling was a professor at Erlangen. He's one of the earlier professors. Maybe people have heard of the Erlangen School. It was a seminary in Germany that had some interesting professors for quite a number of years, and Heffling was a very able professor, interested in stuff that is still relevant today. So he was interested in liturgics. He has I believe it's a two-volume work on baptism and confirmation. And he didn't, he in a way is maybe cut short as far as his life is concerned, because he died fairly young. He was only 51 when he died. So perhaps would have produced more works, but and then of course the book that I translated is known as quite an accomplishment as well.
Yeah. Well, so can you tell us a bit about your earlier impressions of him and how did you kind of approach this topic?
Yeah. Well, you know, that is a bit autobiographical as well. So the way that it was always presented, this ministry issue, which was controverted, there was kind of a spectrum. So you could put Heffling on one side of the spectrum and Leia on the other side of the spectrum, and Walther supposedly is in the middle. And so I when I went to Fort Wayne Seminary, I actually had to give a I had to do an interview there in order to be accepted at that seminary. And one of the seminary professors asked, you know, about the office of the ministry, knew that I'd come from that. And so I gave that kind of answer of Heffling was too much this way, and Leia was too much the other way, and Walther was just right. Of course, I hadn't read Heffling or Leia. The professor, I'll never forget it. The professor basically said, you don't know what you're talking about, which is true. I didn't know what I was talking about, hadn't read it. So, with my impressions, you know, early impressions of Heffling is kind of that he was a boogeyman, you know, somebody that you wanted to avoid outside the pale. And there's a history behind that too. You know, Walther didn't agree with Heffling, so on. So he doesn't have that good of a reputation. And I suppose the reason why I became interested in translating the book is I was doing some work on this issue, and I was trying to find out what was wrong with him. And so I would poke around and I'd read, and it was, you know, it was hard going translating. And then you always think, well, maybe I'm missing something because there's someplace else in the book. And so that was why I decided to translate the book.
Yeah. So I guess to recap, I'm not too familiar with him at all. So as most of, and primarily our audiences are North American Lutherans. Primarily, is he viewed through the filter of maybe what Walther had to say about him, and that's pretty much it. Is that your perception on that, or is there a bit more to
it? I would say that you know, this the discussion of Heffling goes up to the present day. So like Kurt Marquardt talks about him in his book on ministry. You know, there he still kind of occupies that position of being an extremist, I suppose. I could maybe talk about like why, you know, what is the issue behind it? You know, why does Heffling have what's Heffling's view as compared to these others, and why he's thought to be not acceptable. And the way that most people usually talk about Heffling is that he kind of, the word that gets used all the time is he's a functionalist. And so takes the office of the ministry and just says it's a bunch of functions, and then we can kind of arrange it and go from there. And so it's kind of like he abstracts these functions of preaching the gospel, administering the sacraments, and then there's no, you know, it's all up to the church for however the church might ever want to arrange that. So that was why I kind of thought, you know, just from what other people would talk about him, I thought he might be some kind of a rationalist or something like that, you know, that abstracts certain things and then wants to rearrange it. And again, that was really what I was looking for when I was trying to find from him this supposed thing that he does. And he never really did it. Will talk about the office of the ministry, not in a functionalist way, but he does say that everybody has the office of the ministry. So all Christians, by virtue of their baptism, they have the office of the ministry. And that would make him similar to Walther. You know, Walther, after the crisis with Bishop Stefan and such, and his study of Luther, he came to believe that the office of the ministry has been given to the priesthood of all believers, and this then is conferred to the public minister, and to the pastor to carry it out. And then Leia sees a division really between the priesthood of all believers and pastors, and they really don't have anything to do with one another. So Heffling and Walther are similar in the way that they will both emphasize how the priesthood of all believers has been entrusted with these things by Jesus, the preaching of the gospel, the administering of the sacraments. And really, both of them are getting it from Luther. The Heffling book has tons of, the book that Heffling wrote has tons of quotations from Luther. And that's really where it came from. The difference between Heffling and Walther is that Walther will say that the office of the minister, the predict amt oder Pfarramt, is the what he says in his thesis. So the preaching office or the pastoral office, he equates those two things. And so for Walther, there is a pastoral office that goes back to New Testament times that we are bound to keep until Christ comes again, whereas for Heffling, that the way things were in apostolic times is not as set. He sees the pastoral office as a historical development, and especially a Lutheran view of the pastoral office, that this is something that especially came into prominence and clearness at the time of the Reformation, where it became well understood that the preaching of the gospel and the administering of the sacraments is what we have been given. And so at apostolic times, Heffling sees, you know, there's lots of different offices and it isn't clear. And it's only over the course of time that the pastoral office as something distinct really develops, and especially a kind of monarchical understanding of the pastoral office, where there's one pastor in one congregation in a certain geographical location. The New Testament documents just don't seem to indicate that. You know, in Corinth, for example, they are to take turns in the way that they speak. So, and he makes some other exegetical arguments along those lines too. But that would be the big difference, is that Walther sees a pastoral office as something that is required by God, that's in the New Testament, and is bound to be kept until Christ comes again. Whereas Heffling still sees God involved. I think this is another one of the ways that Heffling is often misunderstood, is that it's kind of like God gives the functions to the church and then the church figures it out all by itself without God. And that's definitely not Heffling's view, that things happen in a God-ordained and God-directed way for the organization of the church, the way that different offices arise and so on and so forth.
Yeah. So I think we'll get more into some of his main arguments in a little bit, but I also am interested in the context. And now that was the bigger, broader context kind of on the spectrum, as you said. But now let's get a little more immediately to Heffling and his kind of the occasion for writing, might be the other way to put it. So what caused him? What prompted him? What made him say, "I'm going to sit down and write this book"?
He explicitly says in the book that the reason why he wrote it, and by the way, it started out as an article in the Zeitschrift the Erlangen Zeitschrift, and then it got expanded. It got published by itself after that, and then he expanded it with endnotes. But he wrote that original article because he was concerned about what he calls Puseyism, but I think we are more familiar with as the Oxford movement out of England. And I think that's really important and often overlooked when it comes to Hefling is what you mentioned, the context that he's writing in. So 1848, there are democratic revolts, revolutions throughout Europe, these rumblings of democracy. This is a ways after the French Revolution, but after the French Revolution, there's a conservative turn in Europe, the age of Metternich, and then 1848, enough time has passed and they're beginning to have democratic revolutions, and it appears that the old synthesis between the church and the state are breaking down, or the church and the prince. So even all the way back to Luther's time, some people are familiar with the way that the reformers made the princes the emergency bishops, the not bishop. That is breaking down, and in some locations, it's at least from what I gathered from the translation, in some locations, it seems as though some princes had already given up these roles that they had played for, 300 years as kind of guardians and protectors of the church and so on and so forth. And so in this turmoil, there are very different ideas about how to safeguard the future of the church. And one of those ideas is that the real meat and substance of the Christian church, as well as authority, should be vested in the clergy, that the clergy should become these kind of leaders. And that is the thing that Hefling is very much against. He sees that as a betrayal of Lutheran understanding of what the ministry is about. So he wants to maintain the teaching of the Lutheran confession that for example, each Christian is able to judge their shepherds, so we're not reliant upon the pastor for telling us everything that we are to believe, but we can actually judge our pastors and whether they're being faithful to the word of God or not. That members of the congregation are able to manage their affairs and carry out church discipline. So it's not just the pastor who has the keys. It's not just the pastor who can excommunicate on his own, but that the Christian congregation together is able to excommunicate. The politics at the time are, I think, more important to what's going on than I think is often realized, where you have a conservatism in politics that can get translated over into how things should be thought to be done in the church, that it should be, more monarchical and not democratic. I know especially that was a thing that Wilhelm Leia complained about with Walther's teaching, is that he said this is, and Grabau too. Grabau was Walther's chief opponent here in America. And they said this is going to be a mob. The mob is going to run the church, and they were afraid of chaos. So Hefling does not want the pastors to be kind of monarchs for the church, but then on the other hand too, he is quite conservative or even aristocratic in his understanding of the church. He does not want the church run by just the democratic mob. And this is one thing that's different about Europe too, where in America we have, you know, we freely associate ourselves with a congregation or a church body. In Europe, you know, these, there is no such thing. If you're a citizen, you're a member of the state and you're a member of the church. And Heffling just hated the idea of unbelievers who are voters being able to determine how things should take place in the church. So he has some, I think they're interesting ideas even for our context in America too, even still today, about how to make sure that the discipline, the decisions that are made in the church are done in a responsible Christian way by competent people, and not just thrown up for a vote. So he suggests, for example, that there should be a kind of governing board in the congregations, and it's from those that representatives should be chosen for any kind of representation higher up in the church and for any conventions and that sort of thing. So truly, he would be, I would say, some kind of a moderate. You know, he doesn't want the mob, but he also doesn't want the way that the Christian church operates and turned into some kind of monarchy.
Yeah, and I think it's important to remember too is that the context of this is kind of the era of confessional Lutheranism is kind of the main, in many areas, at least the main field of thought. There's what you do with the Lutheran confessions as you talk about this, and I think part of the degree is what of the debate is what role do the confessions have in this? And he says, as you know, I was reading your translation right up in the introduction. He says, I definitely want to do this, but that was also an aspect in, you know, talk about the two other main figures of Walther and Leia. You know, what do you do with the confessions? And drive that. So that's part of his context too, is he's speaking within a Lutheran dialogue, and he's being aware of that as he's progressing. So not only are there the very important things you just mentioned of the political, religious surrounding current events and such, but also what's going on within the church, and he's navigating through all of that. Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned, as we often do on this podcast, when we're talking about the Lutheran Church in Europe, especially Germany, we have to make sure everyone is aware it is very different from the way it developed and was organized here in America. And in a way, it's that transition of those immigrants who came over. They had to actually sit down and rethink, well, what is the church? We can't just take our prince bishop with us. You know, we have to reconsider this. That was a Walther Grabau's issue. But on a similar way, it's those revolutions of 1848 and other revolutions around that time that caused even the Lutherans in Germany to kind of ask the same question. So in a way, there's a difference on the two continents, but a huge parallel.
And, you know, this occurred to me afterwards. You know, it was, I think a lot of times, that historical component is left out of the way that people think about these issues and the way that I thought about them anyway. It's kind of like I have to figure out these things in the abstract when history is really such an important component, because it wasn't, you know, at the time of Luther, you know, Luther does these tremendous writings in the late 1510s, early 1520s, where they're tremendous if you think about it, because the way that Christians had operated for hundreds and hundreds of years is that the Pope is the vicar of Christ, and the church is run by councils, and so it's all this kind of structure of, we already got our judges in place, and these are the Pope and the councils. And for Luther reject that is an amazing thing. it is very much tied up in how you understand church and also then the ministry. You know, the Catholic system, they definitely have a system, the Catholic system, and it works. It's in a sense, it's consistent with itself. And so Luther had to do this tremendous work of coming to grips with what is the church and what is the ministry, and not just in a Catholic sense, but then he also needed to figure out, how are we going to do church now in Germany when we don't have bishops who organize all these things? And so they worked it out with the prince, and they set up this structure, and it worked well enough, and they had consistories, and the church went on, and things went pretty well in Europe for quite some time. And so people aren't really thinking about these issues of church and ministry all that much between the time of the Reformation and 1848, or at least they're not thinking any kind of new thoughts or going back to this kind of seminal thoughts that Luther was dealing with. Instead, the work was kind of like, this is why we do it, and this is the justification that we have. And so with 1848 in the 1800s, when the old structures are breaking up, these become living and important issues again. And you have all kinds of experiments taking place too. You know, I mean, Bishop Stefan coming over to America, I mean, that'd be quite a grand experiment. He wanted to create, you know, the Zion on the Mississippi, and so on and so forth. So you have that it becomes a topic that can be discussed again. I wish there would be a little bit more of that kind of freeness also today, instead of like, this is the right answer and you should accept it because that's what, you know, your synod or whatever has to say. I think these are worthy issues that should be explored, it has connections with politics and all kinds of things. So the mid-1800s, that's when these issues could be worked on again and discovered again, Walther does it, Hefling does it, Leia does it. They're all working with these issues, trying to figure out what is faithful to the scriptures. How best should we understand these things?
Yeah, that was very helpful. And I think as a history podcast, I always like just talking about history in and of itself, how it works and how valuable it is. And I should have, I didn't have to bribe you to get into that. you've seen the value of history, and over time, it seems like you've grown to appreciate that. The context, I think, is the big thing that provides. Yeah, but you know, that's why we look at certain eras in history, because they are different. And I think when you have those moments of crisis or conflict, and you noted probably the two main eras in Lutheran history, the Reformation, obviously, and now the 19th century, 1800s. Both political and just immigration causing a lot of changes. And at least from my perspective in grad school, the Reformation doesn't just get the lion's share of the attention. It gets like 90%. If you're talking about historical theology, 20th century stuff is still relevant, but that's considered contemporary issues, you know? And so if you're going to talk history, let's talk Reformation. And it's obviously very important and still probably more important than the 1800s. But still a lot happened, more so in that time period than maybe others for some subjects.
And, another thing about the 1800s, too, is that when you think about our confessional Lutherans, we are conservative people. So there's a conservative impulse, that's prominent in the 1800s too. So, you know, a kind of throne and altar sort of mentality where we exalt, you know, the king, and then, you know, that we'd have something similar also in the church. That's in the air. And there's this reaction against the kind of individualism of the Enlightenment, and you know, another movement that would be going on at the same time too would be the Ultramontanist position in Rome, where you know we need the Pope to settle these things, and so the First Vatican Council decrees that the Pope is infallible. I don't know if authoritarian way of solving problems, you might say, in order to avoid the chaos. I think that has its effect in how you understand how the church should be run too.
Yeah. And again, not to get into contemporary issues, but it doesn't take much to see how that applies to, and you mentioned politics, you know, on one hand, you maybe have the super subjectivity of, you know, deconstruction where, you know, how does everything personally affect you? And that kind of shapes reality or truth, you know, how individualistic are we going to get in the church? Or the flip side, you know, how do you react to that? And do you just kind of centralize all power and authority to maintain some things that need to be preserved? Yeah, there's, if you dig deep enough, you can see, oh, wow, this has a lot to say for today.
And that was something that was pretty fun about one of my favorite parts of the book, translating the book, was were the Luther quotations. And he is so fresh, you know, and so, you know, every Christian must judge for himself. And, you know, if there's a pastor who is not doing what he's supposed to be doing, then the congregation can remove him. I forget the exact title, but there's this long title that Luther has, a treatise that's named by it, that basically says, can Christians remove their teachers when they are not doing right? And yes, they can.
So yeah, so Hifling, we like him. Just, you know, in and of itself, the fact he was doing historical theology to do contemporary theology. I'm not saying about his conclusions, but I like him just for the fact that he took that historic approach. That's helpful. So I think you've alluded to them. You made a lot of them, but reference to them. But let's just get right into what are his main points, if you can summarize those simply and clearly for people. You don't want to give the whole book away because you want people to buy and read it, right?
But and we'd be here for a long time.
Yes,
to do that.
That's the benefit of having limited time. We can't get through the whole thing. But what are some of the main points?
So there's the controversial point, which I have already alluded to, and that's his understanding of the ministry. But really, this is a work that is what is indicated in the title, that these are the principles that are involved for how the Lutheran Church is constituted. So it's not just the ministry that he talks about that became the most controversial thing, but he talks about how the Lutheran Church understands the church. What is the church? I think some people might be put off by the term he uses a lot, and that is Protestant. So he really does contrast. There's a Catholic way of understanding these things, and there's a Protestant way to understand these things. And a lot of us Lutherans don't like to be lumped in with the rest of the Protestants, and I can appreciate that. But if you think about the issues that are involved as far as how you understand church, there really are kind of two alternatives. Either the church is this structure that has the Pope at its head and the bishops underneath him, and you need to be connected somehow to this structure, or the church is made up of believers in Christ, and you know, a seven-year-old knows what the church is, that it's all those who hear the voice of the voice of the Good Shepherd. And he talks about what is the church. He talks about how what the church office is. That's the term he likes to use for what we consider, what we usually call the pastoral office, how those should be recognized as having been given gifts and examined and ordained, and how the church should carry out discipline. And he gives ideas for how the congregation should be structured. It is, and towards the end, and this is probably where it's not as relevant for American readers. He has a lot to say about what's going on with the bishops and how the bishops should handle the turmoil that has taken place with the princes, how the princes, as the kind of supreme bishop, how they should handle the political turmoil that's taken place. And it is a work that is contained. It's self-consistent, and it does make this work different than, for example, like Walther's theses. This is not a collection of theses that are then defended. This is more of an organic understanding of what is the church, what is the ministry, how should things be organized in the churches.
Yeah, so I guess now, as we might want to bring up, kind of wrapping up this the discussion of the document, we'll get more into your process. Anything last things you want to say about the importance of this book in translation, about benefit for reading it today? I think we've alluded to it, but get right to the point. Why is it important? Why do we benefit from it?
Yeah, I think it's important. I guess I've already brought this up a bit, but I think it bears repeating that I think Heffling has been misused in secondary literature, where he's instead of taking him at his own words and with his own conceptions of things, people, for example, will just label him as a functionalist. And nobody wants to be that. And so he's beyond the pale. And so let's dismiss him. He doesn't want to be a functionalist. He himself says that he doesn't want the office understood as just some collection of functions. There's a ton of scholarship that has been done that he occupies that area of the spectrum, and that he the priesthood of all believers and the office of the ministry is all confused in him, so they say, and we don't want to do that. And that's just not what he says. I think anybody who reads what he says with an open mind is going to see that that's not what he says. That might not mean that people agree with everything that he has to say, but I don't think it's accurate. And then plus, I think that he brings a lot of clarity to, or at least that's what he did for me. I've mentioned that this is a little autobiographical, I was kind of baffled by these issues all the way through seminary, and even as a pastor for many years. And translating this book has really helped me to understand what these things are, and get a firmer grasp of the real issues, instead of just dealing with names. There's a lot of dealing with names in this controverted area.
What we found frequently on this podcast is this theme of you need to summarize history, right? You can't realistically get every seminary student, every confirmation student to read all of Luther's works, right? You have to summarize the points. And that's there's kind of an ethical aspect to it. As the historian, you have to really be careful to correctly, accurately reflect the author's, not just the words, but even the tensions, intentions, and the context at times as well. And I don't think there are too many unethical Lutheran church historians. You know, I don't think too many are trying to misinform students just to make a point. I hope not. But I think what often happens is, as you summarize, there's always the risk of oversimplifying or missimplifying, if that's a word. And so it's one of the things that you have personally discovered as you went through this process, but it's also a good reminder for all of us as we deal with history. If it's something important that you care about enough to get worked up about, well, maybe dig into the primary sources and see for yourself. And that's probably the best way to approach a lot of these things.
Well said.
Yeah, well, I've said it before. So if people are faithfully listening to this podcast, they're going to say, oh, here he goes again. But I think that point might be a main one to take away from all of these projects. So you talked a bit about responses, at least perceptions. Anything about kind of the immediate response in the historic context that you can say about how people responded to his work?
Yes, it did not go. So a lot of people were appreciative. He mentions this in the four words to subsequent editions, that a lot of people are appreciative of the work that he did and agreed with him. There were a few people who disagreed with him. Leia was an ongoing discussion with him. I guess Leia calls Heffling his chief opponent to his views. There's another guy named Munchmeyer who writes articles against Heffling, and Heffling defends them. So there is an exchange. That exchange doesn't go on for too terribly long, though, because I believe the third edition, the copyright for the third edition, I think is 1853. But I think he concludes the manuscript in 1852. But then he dies in 1853. He dies in April of 1853. So that discussion didn't continue on. And then, you know, in America, too, Walther, by the way, really independently discovers a lot of the same stuff that Heffling talks about in his book, you know, in the struggles after removing Bishop Stefan and so on and so forth, and his reading in Luther. He independently learns and is teaching a lot of this same stuff. And I think in America, he was the prominent theologian, and so he was the one that was studied. I don't think Heffling is studied all that much, but there is, this is how I got on the topic, actually, in a way. There is, in the Wisconsin Synod, J.P. Kaler was familiar with Heffling and approves of his writing. And then also perhaps Schaller too read his original article in the Zeitschrift, and that perhaps affected his understanding of the ministry as well. But those would maybe be a little bit more controversial. The Wisconsin Synod, in their official statement, actually says we reject Heffling. So those might be fighting words, but I'm not, you know, I think there could be something to investigate there.
Yeah, well, that's another question I like to ask our guests. You know, what could you do with this work? And that's maybe one topic to see continental American responses, and of course a lot of Wisconsin Synod listeners too, and maybe that would be a topic to look into. Yeah, another area, and I guess this might be a research area for me, honestly. You know, when Walther and Winniken both traveled to Germany And I noted your dates. He died in 53. So he was around for their late 1851, early 1852. And that was basically a church and ministry debate with Leah and other reasons too. But that was really the primary thing, going to that same area of northern Bavaria. And I've read through that report, but I forgot. Did they visit Hiflung, or is that an area for further investigation?
Yes, they do. Yeah. And it's in a house of my father's that was put out. It's translated. And he does talk about going to Erlangen and has a good discussion. They're very, you know, very cordial. And it's a good discussion that he has with the professors there. But he complains that they hold to Hefling and they just weren't able to come to a meeting of the minds.
Yeah, I think that trip largely is considered not to have been a success for the purpose that I think it gets spun off as, oh, we did a lot of talking. But yeah, ultimately, obviously, the Leah group as well, there was a parting of ways. Yeah. Well, interesting. Thanks for sharing that little tidbit. I will certainly have to do a bit more research in that if I continue my studies the way I think they'll be going. So yeah, thanks for some of the response to that and the broader historical context. Some of these characters who might seem a little more isolated, you dig a little bit. Well, they're not isolated at all. They're really connected to the broader era and context and are interactive with that. So now let's shift gears now as in our final couple of minutes here on the podcast today. Can you tell us about the actual work that you did of researching this, but also translating it? What was your process like? What was that experience like?
I guess it started with a friend. So I mentioned that I was rather baffled by this whole area. And then I discovered another author that I foolishly rejected without ever having read him, and that was J.P. Kaler, and that was many years ago. And so I read J.P. Kaler for many years and got interested in the Protestants, and then I had a friend that assigned me a paper for he wanted me to talk about the Wisconsin Synod position on ministry. And given my history and leaving the ELS and so on and so forth, I was in a way content with being baffled by all these things and not having firm conclusions, because then you can get along with everybody. but he assigned me this paper, so I did research, and I read the primary sources when it comes to the Wisconsin Synod position too. I read the Wauwatosans and was intrigued, interested, and so on and so forth. It's very common whenever you are looking at what people say about the Wisconsin Synod position is that it's Heflingite, and that comes up somewhat frequently. And so that was where I started to poke around in Hefling, and I finished a project, and I had a great friend who sadly died earlier this year. He was a Protestant pastor, and I'd worked on some translations with him. And so after I'd finished some projects, I told him, you know, I'd like to work on this book. Can you help me out? And he agreed to do what he had done with some other stuff, where I would translate stuff and then he'd go over it and find all my mistakes. That's what we did with Hefling. We started in June of 2020, and I'm not an expert at German, and so it's a laborious task. And we worked on it for 3 years, and I have to also admit that I got an awful lot of help from Google Translate. I know I would have gotten things wrong that Google Translate helped me catch if I wouldn't have used it as extensively as I did. So that was how it came about. Once the book was done, I did offer the manuscript to Northwestern Publishing House and Concordia. Neither of them were interested in publishing it. I don't think they, you know, it's, I'm not sure if it will ever be a hot seller, you know. So that was so that's when I said, okay, I'll publish it myself through Amazon, which I had done with a previous book. That was the project that I finished up in 2020. I'd published another book by a Protestant pastor, Paul Hensel, on hardening in the church. And so I was familiar with how you had to format it and all that sort of stuff in order to get it out.
Right. Well, I think most 21st century German translators, unless they're 100% confident and fluent, might confess Google Translate had something to do with the process. You're honest enough to say that. I've definitely used it too for not obviously book length stuff, but other projects. Yeah, very 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 interesting on that process. So, final question, and I guess it can go one of two ways. You've already alluded to some areas where maybe further research could be done. Anything else you think could be done with this topic, this resource, for further research? Or also, are you planning on doing anything else in historical theology?
Yeah, there is actually a kind of fun thing that I'm hoping to do someday. I'd like to get to the library in Mequon look at the Zeitschrift where Heffling's original article was printed, because supposedly there are markings by the hand of John Schaller. I learned about that from a Joel Pless. He did a series of articles on Heffling. And he tracked that down, and I'd really like to look at that. And I do personally believe that there is a strong connection between Heffling and especially J.P. Kaler and John Schaller. John Schaller is often neglected as far as his contribution, especially to church and ministry. Actually, it's usually August Pieper is the one that gets all the acclaim. But John Schaller is the first of the Wauwatosans to write explicitly on ministry. He has an essay on the origins of the New Testament ministry. And I think it's a brilliant essay. I'm very intriguing, I would say is perhaps even an advance of Heffling, but more succinctly, lively, and stuff like that. I think there's definitely worthwhile things to look at as far as the Wisconsin Synod's connection to Heffling, which undoubtedly came from J.P. Kaler.
Yeah, that would be very interesting. Again, see the further connections and applications, you know, what influence was there, or maybe not, right? Yeah, that's always fun to get into the archives, like you said, you see the actual, you know, I was going to say, oh, you might be able to find the document on archive or Google Books, but if you're looking for someone's personal notes, that's when you have to do the fun in-person research. Well, at least it's fun for me.
I'd really like to see the stuff that he underlines, and you know, I'm not sure if I could decipher if he makes any comments, but I'd really like to see what impressed him about that article.
Yeah. Personally, I have to be careful which books I lend out, because sometimes I may write some snarky comments in the margins that I don't want other people to read. So well, maybe you'll get lucky and get something spicy and interesting for historians in the comments. So, all right. Well, we're about at the end of our time today. So thank you, Pastor Holman, for your time. It's been a good time talking with you.
Yeah, likewise.